From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You could call it the most important environmental story that is not getting told. Heat waves in India and Pakistan, a record number of tornadoes in the U.S., forest fires in Portugal, global weather patterns all associated with climate change. And it's a story that is largely not getting much attention from American media, says our guest tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Rob Gelbspan. In newsrooms across the country, Ross Gelbspan says there has been an unfair bias toward balance in the climate change story, so much so that it's helped put the U.S. light years behind other countries in thinking about climate change. The science is unambiguous, but denial is easier, politically and socially, than trying to wrestle with the severity of the problem head-on. For politicians, for the American media, and the American public. But Gelbspan says this need not be the case. Journalists can still get the story right, and Americans can start paying attention before it's too late. Tonight on Point, the global warming crisis, the media, and the consequences of what we don't know. So we put it to you. Do you feel that global warming is being given the coverage it deserves in America's newspaper and television newscasts? Or is it time for the media to start doing a better job of connecting the dots? Is global warming still the biggest environmental story that isn't getting told? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ross Gelbspan. As special projects editor of the Boston Globe, he conceived, directed, and edited a series of articles that won a Pulitzer Prize in 1984. He is the author of The Heat Is On, The High-Stakes Battle Over Earth's Threatened Climate. His new book is Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil and Coal, Journalists, and Activists have fueled the climate crisis and what we can do to avert disaster. Ross, welcome. It's nice to have you with us.
Gail, thank you very much. I appreciate you giving this subject the airtime.
Well, let me ask you about what's changed since 1997 when you wrote The Heat Is On. Situation, I presume, has gotten much worse.
It has indeed gotten much worse. There is a panel of more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they release periodic reports. In 1996, they reported that this warming of the planet is definitely due to human activities, in particular to our burning of coal and oil. In 2001, they came out with another report saying these changes are happening much, much more quickly than we had originally anticipated. And now you hear scientists saying, holy cow, some of these things we're seeing now shouldn't happen until 2075. So that's really what's changed, is that the consequences of the warming of the planet are really becoming much more visible and much more rapid.
So it's not just a problem for our kids and grandkids. It is a problem for us.
It is indeed very much so a problem for us. I think we're going to start seeing consequences in terms of food shortages very shortly. We could start seeing water wars very quickly. So absolutely, it's a very imminent, real threat.
Now, to those people who may be listening to this and saying, whoa, 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 you know, it can't possibly be that bad. What is still contested and by how much and by whom?
There is really no debate about what is happening to the climate in terms of the larger trends. And what we know about the climate, and this is very important, what we know about the climate comes from, as I said, more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries participating in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. The uncertainties are really second level now. They involve things like future rates of warming, specific impacts in particular geographic regions, the role of clouds, some trap in heat, some reflected out. But there's no debate about what's really happening. And you don't need to look at computer models or even the weather. You can see it in physical changes taking place on the planet right now. Heat expands water. Officials are relocating people from island nations that are going under. The glaciers are melting. Three pieces of Antarctic ice shelves have broken off since 1995 as the oceans are warming. A big piece of the Arctic ice shelf broke off last November. Violent weather is increasing. You can see this in the losses of the insurance companies and the rising disaster relief budgets of government. So it's really all around us.
So who are the people who are saying, maybe not so bad?
Really, these are a few, a very small handful of people who some of whom are scientists, some of whom are not, many of whom are in the pay of the fossil fuel lobby of big coal and big oil. If you step back for a minute and understand a couple of things. First of all, what's causing this increase in temperature is the fact that the emissions from our coal and oil burning is trapping in the heat. You also have to understand that the science is very clear on one point. To allow our climate to restabilize and not really take us into really perilous territory requires that humanity worldwide cut its use of coal and oil by 70%, and that threatens the survival of one of the largest commercial enterprises in history. Big coal and big oil together generate more than $1 trillion a year in revenues. So what we're seeing here really, at least from my point of view, is not a science issue and not a technology issue. This is a titanic clash of interests that basically pits the ability of this planet to support our civilization versus the survival of one of the biggest commercial enterprises in history.
Well, 70%. I mean, is that even possible?
Sure, it's possible. We have all the technologies we need, wind power, solar power. We're working on hydrogen fuel cells. There's biomass. There's tidal power. These sources can give us all the energy we use today and more. There's no dispute about that. It's a question of making the transition.
I was struck in your book. You call this a crime against humanity. Strong words, particularly from a journalist. You know, we tend to be just the facts. Generally, we try not to take a position on many things. How is that a crime against humanity, and who are the criminals?
I think the criminals really are some of the elements of the fossil fuel lobby. And the reason I call it a crime against humanity is not the fact that they caused this to happen. This was accidental. This really blindsided us. Nobody knew this was really going to happen except a few scientists in some laboratories. But once it became so clear, and the science became so robust and the impacts became so visible, the fossil fuel lobby should have begun to plan a transition into clean energy. And they have been resisting this and fighting this like mad. Just since 1998, ExxonMobil has spent $12 million bankrolling a few of these naysaying scientists. And to me, this does constitute a crime against humanity. Certainly endangering lots of people in developing countries. Developing countries bear the brunt of these storms and floods and droughts and epidemics because they don't have the infrastructures to really buffer these impacts. We are also really jeopardizing the future of our children. I have two daughters in their late 20s, and by the time they're my age, which is in my early 60s, this is going to be a very chaotic and difficult place to navigate. So I think not the fact that they are burning a coal and oil causes problem, but the lack of response and, in fact, the very, very, very strong resistance by big coal and big oil constitutes a crime against humanity. Absolutely.
This has also become something of a personal crusade for you, and I wonder if there was a single transformative event that opened your eyes to this issue and made you decide to, you know, you could have coasted on your Pulitzer for quite some time, and you chose not to.
It was really an accident, Gail. I'm not an environmentalist, and I didn't do this because I love the trees. I sort of tolerate the trees. But I did it because through various means, I found out that the fossil fuel lobby was paying some scientists under the table to say this is not happening. And I said, boy, if there's this cover-up, what are they covering up? And then I really learned the extent of this. I learned a lot of the science, spoke to a lot of scientists, spoke to a lot of policy people, realized how seriously this issue is being taken in other countries, and that really got my dander up. And from my point of view as a journalist, I felt that these few skeptics and the people who were financing them were stealing our reality. And basically, my whole professional life has been predicated on the belief that in a democracy we need honest information and then we will muddle through to something or other. And they were stealing that opportunity from us.
Hmm. Well, and let's explore that a little bit. I want to hear you make the case about how the media aided and abetted in America's failure to recognize the severity of what was happening here. Is there a basic flaw in how news is gathered? Was it laziness or something a little more sinister?
I think it was a very clever misuse of the ethic of journalistic balance by the fossil fuel lobby. So that in the earlier days when there were still questions about it, every time a reporter would be doing a story about climate, one of these fossil fuel-funded greenhouse skeptics would be on the phone presenting the other side. And they would do this in the name of journalistic balance. To me, journalistic balance really is an ethical obligation when the story involves opinion. Should we have gay marriage? Should abortion be legal? Questions like that. In that case, I think a journalist is ethically obligated to really give competing points of view their best shot, their most articulate presentation. But when it's a question of fact, there is no issue of journalistic balance. And in this case, again, I'm saying this comes from the largest scientific collaboration in history. There really is virtually no dispute about what is going on. And so for journalists to present it as both sides of the issue, maybe yes, maybe not, I think they've done a terrible disservice. And I think they confuse the public tremendously. And the public basically, after being alarmed early in the process, basically said, go away and come back when you really know what you're talking about. That's exactly what the fossil fuel lobby wanted to accomplish, was this confusion about climate change in the public mind. And so I really think it comes from a misunderstanding by journalists of what balance really requires. If you're dealing on a factual basis, and let's say you have one or two dissenters, then I think it's up to a journalist to reflect the balance of thought in the scientific community and give the mainstream scientists 95% of the story and the dissenting scientists a paragraph or two at the end. That's now beginning to happen, but for a long time it wasn't.
So you're saying that there are some issues that we shouldn't really be giving equal time to. You know, you shouldn't have the anti-slavery side and the pro-slavery side, for example, and give them equal weight.
Well, even that's maybe an opinion question. But should we have a debate about whether the fact that this is August 19, 2004? I don't think so. I don't think that is subject to debate. The fact that the glaciers are melting and the oceans are warming and the carbon concentrations in the atmosphere have exceeded those for 420,000 years, there's no debate about these questions.
So then aren't reporters and editors and others all up and down the journalistic food chain obliged to look into where the dissenting opinions are coming from, you know, where this dissenting information is coming from, and see, you know, where's this funding? Where are these people getting their bread and butter?
That's a really good question. And I think it points to another advantage that the public relations specialists at Big Coal and Big Oil played on. Most science and environmental journalists do not have an investigative background. They're not used to looking for where the money comes from. They work very hard to get details of very complex scientific stories right. That's really what their emphasis is. And so for that reason, I think that question was not asked and certainly wasn't pursued by reporters who were covering the story.
You also tell a pretty chilling story in the book about a television person with whom you spoke on this very issue.
This was the a news director of a major news TV news network, and he and I were discussing the fact that one of the most visible consequences of climate change, as you said in the lead into the program, are all these extreme weather events. And I said to him, I've often thought that these extreme weather events are also playing a much bigger portion of news budgets. And if every time the press covered a flood in Haiti or a severe drought or a very extreme storm, if every time they covered one of these events, they should put in a line saying scientists associate this pattern of violent weather with global warming. I think that would mobilize the public in 6 months around this issue. This editor said to me at this news network, we did that once. And I said, what do you mean once? And he said, we did that, but we had a terrific backlash from a public relations operation of representing Big Coal and Big Oil. They came in and talked to our news executives. They made the case that you can't attribute any one storm to climate change, just like you can't attribute any one case of lung cancer to cigarettes. And I said to this editor, I said, I'm saying a pattern. Why don't you mention that this pattern of violent weather is basically a manifestation of global warming? And he said, essentially, the coal and oil lobbyists threatened to withdraw advertising from this TV outlet, news outlet, and they essentially intimidated the news editors into not making that connection again. This is a very hardball fight, and the stakes are very large. So I think it's important to understand that.
We're going to continue talking about that in just a moment. We're speaking this evening with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ross Gelbspan about his new book, Boiling Point. Is the climate change crisis an issue you believe should be covered more by the American media? And if so, how? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about global warming and the American media with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ross Gelspan. His new book is Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil and Coal, Journalists and Activists Have Fueled the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster. Do you agree with Ross Gelspan when he says that the American media was unfairly balanced in its stories about global warming? Is it still? Are editors and reporters ignoring the biggest environmental crisis of this century, or is the American public just not that interested in hearing about it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And right now I want to bring into the conversation Bill Allen, who's joining us from Washington. He is the editor-in-chief of National Geographic. And the cover story of the September issue of the magazine is Global Warning, Bulletins from a Warmer World. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much, Gail.
You know, I was just so taken by your letter from the editor in the opening pages of the September issue, where you talk about how you're aware that publishing all of this may make some people mad. And then you say at the end, I can live with some canceled memberships, but I'd have a harder time looking at myself in the mirror if I didn't bring you the biggest story in geography today. You know, that's a line that just clearly came from your heart.
Well, it did, and you know, I'll have to emphasize one thing. This is not just the biggest environmental story around. This is the biggest geography story, and it's the biggest science story around right now.
And so how do you account for the fact that this story has been, as Ross says, undercovered and underplayed for so long?
Well, I think there are several things, really, Gail, that play into that. One, it is a complex issue, which is no longer open to doubt. But I think there are several things you can look at. One is public interest. While this is the most critical problem that the planet is facing, it's not one that we can correct in a year of hard work and say, hey, we won. We're sort of programmed in this country to say, you know, we want a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a resolution to this thing. We want to know who won. There's also the thing that there's problem fatigue. You know, didn't I hear about global warming last year? Isn't that last year's story?
Or last decades?
Last decades, sure. And then there's also the competition for people's attention in the news media, as well as with the reporters themselves. Political stories are really a lot sexier, and they can be immediate pocketbook issues. We're talking something here that, although we're seeing the effects right now, and it's going to hit our pocketbooks very soon, in the past it's been, well, you know, this is 50, 100 years down the road. Let's not worry about it right now. And there's always a handy scandal around someplace, whether it's money, sex, malfeasances, intrigue, and all these things really have a lot better shot at making the front page.
Hmm. Well, Bill Allen, how did your National Geographic team go about researching the story? And did their findings concur with Ross's reporting in his book?
Well, the most important thing is the answer to the second part. And yes, they absolutely do confirm that. We spent, this is just the latest in a long number of articles that National Geographic has done over the years. Back when I had first gotten to National Geographic, back in 1971, I actually worked on a project at which we mentioned this project, this problem. Then in October of 1990, we did a story on the sun in which we talked about the increasing CO2 in the atmosphere and the rapid changes in wildlife habitats, forcing animals and plants to migrate to different areas or to lose their habitats where they were. And then on through unlocking the climate puzzle, which we did in 98. And then we've done other things since then, the carbon cycle story that we did. We spent 4 years on this story that's in this particular issue of the magazine.
Well,
we did 3 years of research before a photographer and three authors ever even left the building.
Well, I have to say it is beautifully written and reported and certainly should get a lot of people's attention. Again, it's the September issue of National Geographic. So why did you think you were going to be making a lot of people mad about this?
Well, there are still a lot of people who say it's not really happening. I still want to continue with my life just like it is. Don't bring these problems to my attention. I'm very happy doing what I'm doing right now. And I will have to agree with Ross that there's been some pretty effective lobbying on the other side as well. And it has indeed had an effect. So we have an unusual relationship with our readers, which is really more personal and more intense than, I guess, almost any other magazine around. They really feel like they're members of the society, and we treat them as if they're members of the society. And when there is something wrong or something they don't like or don't agree with, let me tell you, they're going to let me know. And I get a lot of letters directed personally to me. How can you say that? And I can expect a lot of those letters on this story.
Well, I imagine. Russ, I want to come back to you. You make the point in the book that this is at least as big a problem as terrorism. How so, and how could it perhaps even be worse?
Gail, I think it could be much worse because we're really talking about the future ability of the planet to support this civilization. I mean, one world-class scientist said to me, this is Dr. James McCarthy of Harvard, who was co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, said, if this unstable climate we are now beginning to see had begun 150 years ago, the planet would never have been able to support its current population. If you're talking about some terrorist attacks, even some more totalitarian regimes, we still have more time to maybe work our way out of that, to resuscitate democracy. Right now, we're really up against nature's deadline, and I don't think the terrorism problem quite puts us in the same place.
I remember you're also telling the story about how at one point you were testifying before Congress about global warming, and that one congressman who actually is from Massachusetts, who's a former chemistry professor, I believe, who came to you and said, well, I agree with everything you said, except I think it's much too late. Someone who presumably knows what he's talking about. But what did you hear from the other congresspeople?
Basically, that they agreed. What I was talking to them about was really a very large set of macro-scale, global-level solutions that would propel a whole worldwide energy transition to clean energy. And they basically just said it's politically unrealistic, even though nobody disagreed with the need for it, the timing of it, and the facts underneath it. So it's a question of the fact that some of us are being politically unrealistic. I also think nature's being pretty politically unrealistic, and that's where the disconnect comes in.
Yeah, a little harder to argue with nature. Well, let's go to some of our listeners now who want to get in on the conversation. Jacqueline's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I want to compliment you on your choice of guests. I agree wholeheartedly with every single point you've made, and I thank you for doing this show.
Well, thank you. And you do work in this area?
Yes. I'm a postdoctoral scientist with Harvard Forest and the Ecosystem Center at Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Excuse me. Yes, I've been studying global change and the implications of global change for forest regeneration, biodiversity dynamics, potential feedbacks of forests to the global climate cycle, how forests might play a role in affecting the way that the CO2 is absorbed, the whole budget for the planet. And I'd just like to say, make two points. First of all, this is totally happening. Real scientists do not argue about this. This is happening, and this is important. And secondly, thankfully, I think the public is totally interested in this issue. And I think that because when I travel, I used to do this because I needed to study as a student. Nowadays I do it because, well, I still need to study. And I bring textbooks with me on global change, and I'm reading them in airports, and I'm constantly asked by people, oh, you study this. You look at this. Is this happening? Is this real? People approach me because they see the articles I'm reading or the titles of the textbooks, and I say, yes, this is happening. Here are the graphs. Here's the data. I was also kind of unconvinced as a college student because I'd heard our media reports, which always present the two scientists, and they don't mention one is supported by the data, one is supported by his fellow scientists or her fellow scientists. And then there's a guy from Timbuktu that says, well, no, we don't think this is happening. And he's also supported, of course, by the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, which was exactly Ross's point a little bit earlier, Jacqueline. Thank you so much. I appreciate the point. And isn't that interesting that as she's going around, Ross, that people, A, do ask her about it, and B, aren't really sure. I mean, I guess we shouldn't be surprised by that, given everything you've been telling us about how journalists are not doing their job and reporting it more.
Well, I think that's right. But I also think that people are really freaked out by the weather. And I think people really instinctively know something is not right. And if, for example, you just think back over the last couple of months, in May of this year, just one storm dumped 5 feet of rain in 36 hours on a part of southern Haiti. You now have something like 35 million people displaced in South Asia from these monsoons. This drought in the western part of the U.S. has surpassed the Dust Bowl. People know that the weather is crazy. They know this is not normal. It's very interesting. When I've done call-in shows in the Midwest, radio programs, I get calls from farmers who are very grateful for the explanations because they say the plants are blooming out of whack, the soil dries out too quickly, the birds are laying their eggs at the wrong time, and they're actually very grateful for an explanation of what's going on.
And Bill Allen, I wonder if you agree with Ross's point that environmentalists may actually be contributing to the problem in some way.
I think that really it's there are a number of factors other than that play into this as well. And I want to go back to the news media and what is going on in newsrooms, whether it's radio, television, or newspapers. There is a lot of pressure from advertisers to deliver an audience. That's what they need. That's what the stations need. That's what the newspapers need to do that. If you have the same pressures of a daily news cycle that you're fighting, and you've got to get something out there, and the staffs are overworked, they don't really have the time in many cases to delve into the very things that we have the luxury of doing at Geographic and a few of the other large newspapers do. So they're really obligated to sort of pick up what is told to them in other areas and is going to be a little sexier, a little more attractive, and is going to sell newspapers or make the lead on the evening news. For example, you know, in the old newsroom story, if it bleeds, it leads. If you've got something that is a traffic accident or a war or something like that, that's going to be your lead story. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get in and make the point that this long-term thing is probably even more important than those shorter-term things are to the survival of people on this planet.
Sure. I want to take another call, but first, Ross, I just want to give you a chance to quickly, in a line or two, if you can, get back to that point about how environmentalists may perhaps not be solving the problem as much as they think they are. They may actually be contributing to it.
Unfortunately, Gail, a lot of the big environmental groups work in an atmosphere where progress is measured in very small increments. They are dealing with Congress and dealing with the legislature, so they're very happy if they can get an extra mile or two in the automobile efficiency standards. And the science is real clear. We need to cut these emissions by 70-80%.
Changing your light bulbs is not going to do that.
So that's right. Running around with compact fluorescent light bulbs, which is certainly an important piece of it. But while the planet is imploding, I think a lot of these groups are afraid of feeling marginalized. I think they certainly feel a need to stay connected to the power structure. And they may even be afraid of offending or dismaying funders if they really were to step out and tell the truth. But I find that really the much less compromised group of people are the scientists than the environmental groups at this point.
All right. Let's go to Wakefield, Massachusetts. We want to hear from Tom. Hi, Tom. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, Gail, I must say I'm terribly disappointed by the very one-sided nature of this program. Mr. Gelsman has made a crusade of scaring the American public, and I absolutely disagree with his contention that the media has not given proper attention or coverage to his side of the story. I live in Greater Boston. That is all I read. I do not see hardly a word in the Boston Globe from the opposing point of view that he claims is getting 50% of the coverage. Neither do I see that on network television. All I see is his side of the story. It's accepted as given as an absolute fact that that global warming is caused by human activity, when in fact, for the vast majority of the Earth's history, the temperature has been warmer than it is today. The Earth has been warming for the last 15,000 years since the end of the last ice age. This is not something that, and furthermore, the vast majority of carbon dioxide production does not come from human activity. It comes from natural sources. So for this gentleman to say that the carbon industry, the coal and oil, have been selling the public on a falsehood is nonsense. I think this is the worst sort of propaganda, big lie propaganda, trying to, and what's worse, he's trying to shut off opposing points of view. I mean, this is incredible.
Well, we've been happy to hear your opposing point of view, Tom. Let's put the question directly to Ross.
Well, I think the question that Tom poses is the question that the United Nations took up in 1988. And they said, gee, the planet's getting warmer. Is this due to the natural cycles of the climate, to natural variability, or is this due to something else? And this body of 2,000 scientists worked and they produced a report in 1995 saying this is due to human activity. These carbon levels, which were the same for 10,000 years at 280 parts per million, began to skyrocket just as the world began to industrialize using coal and oil from about the middle of the 19th century. And there's a very strong correlation between our activity and the warming of the planet. In fact, what Tom mentioned about the planet warming is not completely true. There is a team of scientists who reconstructed the global climate for the last 1,000 years, and they found that actually from the year 1000 AD until about the middle of the 19th century, the planet was cooling very, very slightly by about a quarter of a degree. And then from that point on, it begins to heat up at a rate that is unprecedented in the last 10,000 years, and that corresponds exactly with this explosion of industrialization and this really ramping up of the use of fossil fuels.
You know, if you take a look at the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and this is based just on the facts, not on anything, any political position or anything else, when you do computer projections and computer analysis of what is going on, if you take a look at just what the natural cycles are in the system, that does not explain where we are. It is only when you take into account what the humans have added to that cycle that you find out that the reality that we see on the ground matches what the computer projection is on what should happen.
I'm not exactly sure of what you're saying, Tom. I know in terms of the measurement of carbon dioxide that it was 280 parts per million until about 150 years ago. It is now almost 380 parts per million. It's 379 as of last measurement. And that additional increase over and above what the natural level is clearly a result of our burning of fossil fuels.
No, that's exactly what I'm saying, Ross. This is Bill, and I'm saying that in the past, as if you take a look at what the computer projections are and try and match them with what the observations are, it is the only time that the computer projections match what is actually going on the planet is when you factor in what humans are doing. That means that there is really no chance that this is just a natural occurrence. It can only be explained by the contribution of humans to the equation.
Thanks, Bill. My apologies. I was confused, too. Thanks for clearing that up. We're talking this hour about the global warming crisis and the American media's treatment of what may be the biggest environmental story of the century. We'd like to hear from you, too. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about global warming, the media, and the consequences of what we don't know. How much do you know about the climate change crisis? Do you think the claims are exaggerated or right on? And if we are in the midst of a crisis, what do you want to know about what can be done from an environmental standpoint, from a political standpoint? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ross Gelspan. His new book is Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil and Coal, Journalists and Activists Have Fueled the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster. Also on the line with us from Washington is Bill Allen, editor-in-chief of National Geographic magazine. The cover story of the September issue is Global Warning, Bulletins from a Warmer World. And we want to go back to our phone lines now and hear from Robbie, who's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Robbie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually an Indian citizen living here in the United States. While developing countries like India and so many other European nations, they have signed the Kyoto Protocol. What stops the United States from doing so? And whatever may be the reason, you think it's... Do you think it can be rightly justified?
All right, Ravi, good question, and one that you address in your book, Ross.
Absolutely. Really, the resistance has come from the contamination of our political system in the United States by money and by the real stronghold, the lock that the oil and coal lobbies have in Congress. President Clinton, as you know, tried to move in that direction, and Congress totally shot it down. That was in 1997. President Bush then withdrew us from the Kyoto Protocol on the grounds that it's unfair to the United States because it exempts the developing countries. At some point, President Bush might stumble across the fact that it was his father who approved the exemption of the developing countries, and for good reason. We in the North have created the problem. We in the North have the resources to begin to address it. We in the North should take the first steps, and the rest of the world should come along. So I think what's happening right now is you've seen a complete swing away from multilateral cooperation in a lot of areas. Bush's withdrawal from Kyoto is probably the most prominent one. I know it enraged many, many people in Europe as well as in developing countries. I think that rage is still simmering. I think it's been temporarily papered over by the anti-terrorism coalition, but it will resurface again. So my hope is that if there is a regime change in the U.S., or much more coverage by the media, much more popular demand, then we will see the United States move back with the community of nations and move forward on this issue.
Thanks for the call, Ravi. And Bill Allen in Washington, I want to put a similar question to you. If massive global cooperation is necessary, how likely do you think that is, and especially now?
Well, I think the lead is going to have to come from the administration in Washington. When you talk to people in Europe or around the world, for whatever reason, they seem to be much more connected to this. I know the editors of our editions of National Geographic magazine in Europe simply cannot understand why the United States has not gotten on board with this. The issue seems so clear to them. And I guess perhaps in the case of the Netherlands, of course, they see exactly what is happening there. Germany is much more attuned. Bangladesh certainly would be. A lot of the countries that are seeing their coastlines begin to disappear now certainly are in this. But the lead really has to come from the United States in order to do that. And that means it's going to take some political will on the part of Congress and on the part of the president.
Ross, what about that?
I think Bill is right, but I think there's one point that's being overlooked here, Gail, and that's that this issue is being spoken of in a very defensive way. We're talking about our fears about climate change. Nobody is talking about the extraordinary potential, transformative potential, for really addressing this problem. If we were to spearhead a global transition to clean energy, that would create millions of jobs all over the world. That would begin to turn impoverished and dependent countries into trading partners. It would raise living standards abroad without compromising ours. Economically, this is a no-brainer. On the negative side, very briefly, the United Nations recently said that within this decade, we will lose globally $150 billion a year to climate impacts. Munich Reinsurance has said within the next couple of decades, that figure will be $300 billion a year. And the biggest insurer in Britain has said that unchecked climate change can bankrupt the global economy by the year 2065. And on the opposite side, every dollar invested in energy in poor countries creates way more wealth and jobs than the same dollar invested in any other sector. It allows local populations to begin to start homegrown industries. It will expand the amount of trade in the global economy. It would leave us with a much wealthier and a much more secure world.
Well, and actually picking up on that point, there's an article in Business Week that says that companies that have cut emissions have discovered, often to their surprise, that it saves money and spurs development of innovative technologies. And here's a quote from Michael Northrup, who's co-creator of the Climate Group, which is a coalition of companies and governments set up to share such success stories, in which he says, "It is impossible to find a company that has acted and has not found benefits." So this is not just a downer story, as you point out. In fact, you paint a picture of a very different kind of world if we turned our attention in a very different direction here.
Absolutely. I mean, we are living in an extremely fractured and polarized world right now. And I think we have this issue, which really could overcome alliances. It requires the nations of the world to work together against a common threat that is virtually unprecedented. The losses are becoming very apparent. And I think the overall expansion of trade and wealth and really security also, I think this very much would address some of the economic desperation that underlies a lot of this anti-U.S. sentiment. It's very, very important for that,
and
for
Gail,
that
this,
to be seen.
This is Bill, and I think that some companies are certainly ahead of the politicians in this country in understanding what's going on. And when you look at Europe, of course, I believe the Business Week article also points out about the Swiss reinsurance company that is now questioning CEOs and major executives of corporations to say, what are you doing to adapt and to make sure that you are either not going to contribute to global warming or are ready for it before we're going to insure you?
Let's go to Brian now. He's on the line from Framingham, Massachusetts. And Brian, I understand you know a little bit about this topic, too.
Yeah, thanks, Gail. And I just wanted to say that this discussion has been very good, and I really appreciate the perspectives of Ross and Bill during the program. I wanted to just give a perspective of my own. I'm a policy consultant working on with industry and government and environmental stakeholders in the Northeast United States on the first ever initiative to cap CO2 emissions from the electricity sector in the 10 Mid-Atlantic and Northeast states. And the idea being is that this initiative, being the first of its kind in the United States, likened to the European emission trading scheme that's underway, will be underway in 2005. The idea is that we possibly could create a model program that could be potentially adopted by other states and regions, particularly California and Washington State and Oregon, to create momentum and to create the signal that this isn't going to be economic disaster. It might be something that will create jobs and increase security and diversify the energy resources of the United States, lo and behold, all the while mitigating risks on climate change and reducing other air pollutants and having other environmental benefits. But I think the bottom line is that what we've heard over the last 45 minutes has been indeed true. The media has played a significant role. And, in fact, President Bush has been pointing to the uncertainty for reasons not to take action. And it's pretty interesting that the states, the governors in the states, and even industry CEOs are beginning to lead the parade. So with all policy issues, I think that at some point the political leaders, the president of the United States, congressional members, et cetera, will want to jump in front of this parade. Mm. And more power to them when they do that, because the United States is missing out on a global opportunity.
We got it, Brian, and thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. To that point, Bill Allen, you know, in other issues over time, apartheid, civil rights, others, there is often what's recently been described as a tipping point, you know, where suddenly a situation becomes so clear that change does, in fact, happen. I wonder what you think it might be in this instance.
Well, I think before the time when conclusive evidence is there that everybody on the street can say, hey, we have a climate change here. It is way too late to do anything. I think the tipping point is really now. I think unless we do something very soon, we've already decided what the climate of our children and grandchildren is going to be. If we do not do something now, we're talking generations on down that have no chance. Now, I tell you, I wouldn't want to be a governor in Sacramento, regardless of my build of my body, when the water runs out for Los Angeles. And unless something is done to correct some of these long-term problems, the water situation in the West, and that means as well as the ranchers out there, which are the basis of some Republican support, in California, when the cities begin to run out of water because of the climate change and the lack of water there, this is going to be a tipping point, but it's going to be too late. It needs to be done now. I think we're at the tipping point.
And Ross, what about that? Are we there now?
I think we certainly are there now, Gail. I think we're a little bit past the tipping point in terms of the sense of urgency. And I think the other tide that we need to go against here is this tide of sort of free market fundamentalism. I've talked to a number of oil company executives and presidents. They say off the record, we can do this change. We can transform ourselves into clean energy companies, but we need the governments of the world to regulate us so we can all do it in lockstep without losing any competitive standing in the industry. The frustration comes when you say, well, you go on the record and say you want government regulation. And they say, no, this conversation never happened. But I think there's also, as Bill and as Brian, the caller, pointed out, growing sentiment within business. In a couple of months ago, the chairman of Shell said he is really very worried for the planet. Last fall, the president of Entergy, which is one of the biggest utilities in the U.S., says we are going to be leaving a grim, grim legacy for our children. So when you're getting Shell and British Petroleum and Entergy speaking this way, I think we're very close to the time for change. And I think what's needed is some leadership. And then you will see a very quick mobilization of industry, of activist groups, of the religious community, of all kinds of people around this issue.
Let's go back to our phone lines, this time to Norwood, Massachusetts. We want to hear from John on this point. Hi, John.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Really quick, because I know we're close to the end of the hour. There's been a lot of discussion about the big picture and things on the political and industrial scale. A lot of times I think people call in and, you know, people want to know what they can do on an individual basis because they experience a little of the problem fatigue that you've described. Can't really do much about Enron personally. But if NPR were to do stories more on individual things that one can do, you know, is there something I could get for my car or for my chimney to make me more carbon neutral in my daily life and leave a better legacy for my kids?
Right, John, we got it. Let's quickly put that question to Bill Allen in Washington. Are we beyond the point where individual efforts are going to make much of a difference, or at least is it worth it just to make everyone feel as if they do have a part in this?
Any participation is going to help, however small it is. Anything that can be done along the lines of some of the things that Ross was talking about earlier. But I think the big thing is to make enough noise so that the politicians are going to listen and know that there is going to be support for people who will take the steps that are necessary to have this fundamental change. And it's that kind of support that I think everyone can do.
And, Ross, would you agree with that? Time to light a little fire here under Washington and State capitals?
I think social change has to happen at every level, from individual lifestyles to community changes to city and state and national policies to international agreements. Unfortunately, I don't think you can solve this problem by lifestyle changes. I think even if we all sat in the dark and rode bicycles, we would not stop global warming. On the other hand, it's a very important statement to make. It does contribute to awareness of the problem. It limits a person's emissions. But I think political action is what's really required. I think we need the kind of regulation that will require automakers to only sell us hybrid and fuel cell cars, that force utilities only to give us green electricity. So I think it has to happen at all these levels.
Knowledge is a start. Thank you both so much for being with us. Ross Gelspan, author of The Heat Is On, also his new book, Boiling Point. And Bill Allen joined us from Washington, editor-in-chief of National Geographic. The cover story is in the September issue, Global Warning, Bulletins from a Warmer World. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.